Good morning.
We have places to go now. We have hairdressers to visit. We have churches to attend. We have gyms to work out in. We have outdoor pubs. Yes! Welcome! Give me a flat manky Guinness in a bar with flies. I don't give a damn. I'm thirsty now.
Yeehaw! Thursday morning. But whoa, hold them their horses. Here comes Friday.
So I was all delighted with myself yesterday, playing Ode to Joy and excited about where it's all going. And then Leo Varadkar shows up on primetime and he starts saying this.
At least until pretty much everyone is vaccinated, we're still going to be battling this virus. And even when everyone is vaccinated, this virus will be with us perhaps for eternity and certainly with us somewhere in the world. So it is going to require ongoing vigilance. And there is an emergency break.
There's a what? No one told us about that. I'd already booked my taxi for the pub. I've got a week off. And then he says that it's going to be with us for eternity. And then there's a break. For the love of God, you can't just say that the party's on, but you can't come unless you've got X, Y, Z, four hats, six...
Steady, Ryan. There is a party. Now, it might be more of a soiree than a rave, but a little party nonetheless, outdoors, etc., etc. But emergency break or no, the news was mercifully good. Dr. Gerald Barry, Assistant Professor of Virology at UCD, gave his reaction to the government's easing of restrictions to Mary Wilson on Morning Ireland.
In general, very much in favour of what they've done.
And do you say that as a member of society like all of us who has found the lockdown difficult? Or are you saying that as a virologist who looks at the science?
Yeah, well, I think both, actually. I mean, initially, I very much said it as a person, as a human being that has been experiencing, like everyone else, the pain of this for the last 15-odd months. But then when you look at the details of what they've done, effectively, they've front-loaded, in May in particular, low-risk things that are going to, you know, bring huge benefit to society and hopefully give people this kind of chink of light that we've been all looking for. Things like activities outdoors, for example, or even kind of personal services like hairdressing. You know, the UK have done a lot of detailed study on this, and they've shown that those kind of activities have a relatively low risk associated with them. Of course, where it might get a bit trickier is when we get into June and we start to talk about hospitality, hotels,
and the larger reopening. Yeah.
So one cautiously optimistic virologist, because they are people too. But what if the bad thing happens? Taoiseach Micheál Martin spoke to Mary, who wanted more detail on this handbrake turn business.
If those metrics start to go wrong on you, if those numbers you're talking about in hospitals and ICUs, if that R number starts to increase, what are you going to do? What is the plan? Is it for localised lockdowns? What does the emergency break actually mean?
Well, first of all, there are two phases here. The first phase, the month of May, which is gradual and which will bring key sectors back into play and people back to work and businesses back into operation who desperately need to get back into operation in terms of future viability. But we will, you know, in the past we have intervened, you know, we've delayed reopenings and so on. But I would be more than hopeful that we can see May through. We will assess it towards the end of May in terms of what, you know, in terms of June and beyond June. I actually would believe, and given the evidence so far in terms of how people have behaved and that these particular sectors have very strong guidance attached to how they will reopen, I think we're in a good space. Mm. We will not be afraid to intervene, in short, if there are worrying trends in this.
And you want to be hopeful today, and people are optimistic today, but people have come with you along the way and you've acknowledged that, so they need you to be frank with them as well, and they probably need to know what they face if the numbers start to go back, at what point the government would start, and NPHET would start to pull down the shutters, would start to apply the emergency brake. Because, you know, we have different numbers in different counties. So could we see localised county lockdowns of some sort if the numbers start to go wrong?
Well, in the context of the variant B117, NPHET over the last number of months have been clear on a national approach to this in terms of the management of the virus itself, and that is the direction of travel. We would always, of course, within our overall framework, there was always the facility for county by county. There's never just one variable in terms of decision making, and they do range from case numbers to hospitalisation in ICU, to severe illness and to death, and to deaths. And that's where the vaccination is significant.
And vaccination is where it's at, and we're doing well. But back to Dr. Gerald Barry, who was sounding a very minor note of caution.
If we get to this, you know, golden mark of 80% by the end of June, huge benefits are going to come with that, you know. But I think we have to err a little bit of caution, because right now we're only at about, I think, about 30% of people
That's
have had
right.
one shot of a vaccine. So we're nowhere near kind of fully protected yet. And while things are beginning to open, the door is creaking a little bit and letting a bit of light through, you know, we're not fully protected yet. So we need to go still a bit cautiously, you know, and we look at kind of countries that have maybe gone a little bit fast across the world. Chile is a really nice example of that.
What happened there?
Well, at about 35% of the population vaccinated with one shot, they decided to open up because it was their summertime, and they opened up restaurants and pubs and things like that. And they saw a huge surge. Now, they're using a different kind of vaccine that's arguably not as effective as the one we're using. But also the general levels of vaccination across the population were not high enough, basically. They were roughly equivalent to where we are now. I suppose they naively thought that that level was maybe enough to give them that ability to open up. And they were caught by it. Now, thankfully, we're not doing that. You know, a big mistake would have been, for example, to open up indoor dining right now. But we're not doing that. And that's been pushed, you know, relatively far down the line when we should have far higher levels of vaccination.
Dr. Gerald Barry on Morning Ireland. And while our vaccination programme is nicely picking up pace, this is a global pandemic. And as such, none of us are safe until all of us are safe. This week saw India reach levels of infection on a scale perhaps difficult to comprehend. The total number of infections has now passed 18 million. Brian Dobson spoke to Margaret Harris of the WHO on yesterday's News at One.
The figures are really truly alarming and shocking. 3,500 deaths reported in India yesterday. And we're still, it seems, some weeks away from the peak of this surge.
Yes, it's really, really heartbreaking to see what people are suffering in India. And it's also a salutary lesson, a horrible lesson for the world about how this virus can take off. If it finds a crack, it exploits it.
I mean, clearly there's an urgent, critical need for medical equipment, medical supplies. At the moment, does India have anything like sufficient quantities of these?
Well, you know, before they had this huge acceleration, they did. But this is the problem. This virus it gives you such a severe illness that you must be treated in complex ways in hospital with things like oxygen and ventilators, so you simply run out. And it's great to see that Ireland has sent the oxygen concentrators, for instance, because that is a very useful piece of equipment that can suck the air out, just normal room air, and compress take the oxygen in it, compress it, and provide it to the patient. Mm-hmm. And all you really need is an electrical supply to do that. So those are really, really useful bits of equipment. But yes, all of us around the world right now have to focus on supporting India and helping fill the gaps that they are now seeing.
Margaret Harris of the WHO. And as we all well know, global vaccination is key. And while supply issues here have dogged our rollout from the get-go, this week saw NIAC approve both the Johnson & Johnson and the AstraZeneca vaccine for the over 50s. GP Dr. Ray Wally, and member of the National COVID-19 GP Liaison Committee, spoke to Audrey on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
In terms of, I hope you don't mind me saying, you're in the over 50s age bracket, would you take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine if offered? No problem.
I would take the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I would take the AstraZeneca vaccine. I'd take all of those vaccines at whatever age group I was, because the chance of getting a side effect is the same chance, getting a serious side effect is the same chance being hit by lightning. I'm not unaware of people who've been hit by lightning. I've never met somebody, having been a doctor for many number of years. It is a rare side effect. What's more is we know what we're looking for. So even in the people who are getting these side effects, which are rare, we're picking them up earlier, and we have a process in place in this country whereby you go to your local general hospital or you go to a general practitioner who will refer you to local general hospital. And we have a system in place now that you contact the specialist units for guidance, or you may be transferred. But these are rare side effects. So again, with the Johnson & Johnson one, we're talking 0.9 per 1 million vaccines in the over 50 age group. So we're talking a rare adverse event.
And with more supply, does that mean the target of 80% of adults receiving their first COVID vaccine by the end of June? Is that a realistic one? Health Minister Stephen Donnelly joined Clare yesterday. But first, when is the end of June again?
The 31st of June. The 31st of June obviously does not exist. My granny taught me that rhyme when I was seven, sorry. but the point I was trying to make was, you know, there's been a lot of focus on the end of June, which of course is the 30th of June. But, you know, the last week in June, hundreds of thousands of people will be vaccinated. The first week in July, hundreds of thousands of people will be vaccinated. So it was a date that was given that there's been a lot of focus on. But really, you know, what we have to do is ensure that as the vaccines come in...
You're softening us up there now. You're softening us up. You're not going to be at 82% by the end of June, and you're just telling us that that's a bit of a soft date now. That's what I hear.
Well, I appreciate that's what you might hear. I guess I'm just trying to be transparent, which is, as the vaccines come in, we'll get them out. If the vaccines come in as they have been promised, then we will be on track for the end of June.
Health Minister Stephen Donnelly. So, fingers crossed and... More on that later. Back in a bit. Welcome back. As we tentatively dipped our toe back into normal life, the news agenda also began to return to business as usual. Political anoraks gleefully dusted off and donned with not one, but two significant political stories, which mostly had nothing to do with COVID. First up, Fine Gael TD for Dublin-based South Owen Murphy announced he was leaving politics after 12 years. He'd been taking stock and wanted new challenges. But, as he told Clare, politics can be a brutal business, bruising and at times intensely personal. Certainly, he acknowledged his time as housing minister had not been an easy one.
You seem to be the focal point, though, for anger. And at one point during the election count, you were heckled, weren't you, at the count centre, and the Gardaí had to be called.
Yeah, but actually that wasn't the first time that had happened to me, because at the local elections, when I'd gone along to check in on the Fine Gael candidates, the same thing had happened. And I was used to that. And I think that's part of the job. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't bother me, but when you're the Minister for Housing in a housing crisis and you're making decisions that affect people's lives, or if people feel that you're making the wrong decisions or you're leaving them behind, they're going to have a problem with you. And I think when it comes to politics, criticism is absolutely fair. You've got to hold public people to account. When it comes to getting, you know, personal abuse, I don't like it. Who likes that? I understand it too, because people are hurting and they see you as not.
Are you being a politician now saying that? Because you're not a politician anymore. And if this really got to you, you are allowed to say it. You've just given yourself permission at 9 a.m. to say this was a horrible way to live.
No, it was tough. It was tough. But it was like, you develop coping mechanisms. A lot of miles spent out on Sandymount Strand running at night when I get home from work to, you know, when you'd had a difficult day. It's got absolutely nothing to do with why I'm leaving. But I think it's a discussion that we should have in Irish life, because, you know, while I did get abuse, the people around me got abuse as well. And
Your family?
Yeah. You know, a previous girlfriend of mine used to get the most horrific abuse to her face in public. And that's not on. And I talked to my colleagues in the Dáil and some of the women politicians, and, you know, and I'm all for quotas and we should support them. But unless we have a bigger conversation about this, we aren't going to be able to attract women into politics, or maybe even new people. But it's got nothing to do with why I'm leaving.
And as the interview was about to finish up, Claire asked this, which elicited a very interesting response.
Do you think that politics now is a much nastier place than it was when you started 12 years ago?
I think there's a couple of things on that, and I've been trying to formulate my thoughts on this properly, so forgive me if I don't get them out properly. Social media has driven a type of 24/7 politics which I don't think is sustainable. Like, when you're minister, you're always on. And Enda Kenny said to me, look, you have this privilege for a short period of time, you're going to have to do it all of the time. That's just how it works. And I get that, and I did that. But every TD now, every councillor always has to be tweeting, always has to be doing these things, always has to be answerable. And I think that's going to just not be sustainable. But there's a separate thing happening in politics as well. The whole way a democracy is meant to function is about people coming into a room who've been chosen by others to make decisions. It involves debate, it involves compromise. You need to be able to talk to the people and flesh things out and have a degree of trust in those engagements. The more tribal politics becomes, the less that's possible, the less compromise. I mean, Leinster House is at its best when it compromises coming out of it, because it reflects the will of the people working together to compromise, not one person putting their will on someone else. But if we move into too tribal a type of politics, too much of a personality or identity politics, then democracy will become a tyranny, like a tyranny of the majority, but still a tyranny. And we'll move to a type of US type politics, which I don't think we want to.
And do you think that's happening?
I fear that there's a slippage. Social media is the new battleground, but we're still building the rules around that battleground.
Former Fine Gael TD Owen Murphy with Claire on Tuesday. Oh, but for the poll corps, a by-election. All their birthdays come together. Here's political columnist with the Irish Examiner, Alison O'Connor.
What did you make of the news?
I was thrilled. I mean, because there's some normal political excitement.
And what about Owen Murphy's future career plans?
But I did smile when I saw international cooperation, human rights and democracy. It reminded me of something a Miss World contestant would say in terms of what she, what she would be doing. With the inner...
Oh, the cruelty of it. But as one politician chose to step off the plinth, another was pushed. Tuesday saw a heave against Arlene Foster as leader of the Democratic Unionist Party. She would resign on Wednesday. But before we get there, the tipping point, not the substantive reason, but certainly for hardliners, a step too far, was her abstention on the vote in the Northern Ireland Assembly last week, which passed a motion supporting a ban on so-called gay conversion therapy. On Sunday, Miriam O'Callaghan spoke to SDLP councillor Pete Byrne from South Armagh, and he talked about his life in Northern Ireland.
What was it like for you growing up gay?
Beyond difficult. Really, really difficult. I lived, as you said at the start, in Crossmaden, a small border town. Everybody knows everybody. A business in the town, working a family business, involved with the football club, the soccer club in the town. And I suppose everybody's sort of set in their ways, and when you're looking around, you know, growing up as gay, you don't see the support around, you don't see anybody else like you. You see most people sort of growing up from the LGBT community had moved out of Crossmaglen, so you're sort of looking around for some support, and it's not there. So I met my now husband in 2006. Within weeks after that, I thought, I can't do this. And I booked a one-way flight to Australia, and I went to Australia on my own in October 2006 and was there for 15 months. I literally couldn't face it.
He did return to Northern Ireland and moved in with his boyfriend, now husband, but he was not open about their relationship.
I didn't actually tell people. You can count on one hand the amount of people that I actually came out to. People think that this coming out is, you know, you sit people down and you tell absolutely everybody. I told four people. Everybody else sort of I let find out, because I physically couldn't do it, you know, to sit down and actually have that discussion. So I told one person in my family, and then everybody else sort of found out. So yeah, we moved in together when I came back, and I sort of started to try and build a life. And every time I would make a decision, you know, for example, when I got engaged, I felt, how far can I live my life without hurting others? You know, I had the comments whenever I got engaged 2 years later. I had the comments that you're pushing it too far now. You know, people have accepted that you're living together. Stop rubbing people's nose in it. You know, you're pushing it too far. So that sort of knocked my confidence and put me back. So when I became an elected rep, I felt that I had to start speaking out. It was deeply uncomfortable, really uncomfortable to speak out. And I think I became a councillor in 2016, and I went to my first Pride in 2016, that summer. I became a councillor in January. And that was the first Pride that I had walked in. It might seem like a very simple thing for people. It is really, really difficult. This week, when I spoke on the conversion therapy issue and how I struggled mentally growing up, I found it very, very uncomfortable. But I know it needs to be said. I know it needs... My story needs to be out there because it will help people, because growing up, I didn't have that help.
Now, Pete and Trevor married, and then Pete's brother asked Trevor to be a godfather to his first child. Quite the honour. But his local parish priest refused. Now, they moved parish, so they did get around it. However, Pete decided to visit the priest in question, an encounter that was upsetting, to say the least.
I know the priest personally. Everybody knows everybody in a small village personally. And I asked why, and I felt angry, and I sort of threw up a few things. Like, you know, some people say, well, how come right across the Catholic Church, you know, there seems to be, in my opinion, priests that would be identify as LGBT or of, you know, same-sex attraction or whatever. And he said to me that that's true, but we believe that you're born into sin. Mm. You're a sinner. You were given an itch, and you can't scratch it. You've pretty much give your life to God, be celibate, and you went ahead and scratched yours. So there's the difference. And that really, really... I thought I could fob it off, Miriam. And I says, listen, you can have your opinion and I'll have mine, and I go on about my life. But as I said this week, you know, that night, that week was my first time I had a panic attack at night. And something that... a feeling I've never had before, waking in my sleep screaming, couldn't breathe, genuinely thought that I was going to die, and that spiraled to 5 or 6 a week for months. Mentally, it's all building up in your head, and because we have a culture of probably not speaking about our feelings in this country, you let it build up, and you think you're dealing with it. So I effectively keep myself busy so I don't think, that I don't think in time, and I don't go through these things in my head, but obviously when I'm resting at night, it's going through my head and it's having a massive effect.
And Pete talked about listening to last week's debate on gay conversion therapy.
Parts of it I found very, very difficult. I found that the debate was largely respectful at the start, but, you know, some of the comments, it just feels like, as an LGBT person, it feels like you're on trial, effectively, to have your lifestyle debated and discussed time and time again in Northern Ireland. So, you know, I'm glad it passed with 59 votes, and we need to move to legislate before the end of this term.
STLP Councillor Pete Byrne with Miriam on Sunday. Now, the DUP leader Arlene Foster had abstained from that vote, not in itself the reason for the revolt against her, but for hardliners, the excuse they were looking for. By Wednesday afternoon, the writing was on the wall and she resigned. Political editor for the Belfast Telegraph, Suzanne Breen, gave her analysis to Drive Time.
This move on Arlene Foster has been on the cards for a long time. The main problem has been the protocol for Arlene Foster. If Brexit had settled down, bedded down quite easily in Northern Ireland, it may well have been different for her. But when loyalists started to take to the streets, she then had to change her position on the Northern Ireland protocol. Until then, she had been saying that the protocol, while not perfect, provided opportunities for businesses in Northern Ireland and unionists should work for it. She then had to radically alter her position and say that it had to be binned. But that didn't appease the people on the street. So she lost the support of working class loyalists. She lost the support of paramilitaries. And then with the gay conversion therapy, she annoyed the religious wing of the party. She had too many enemies. She represented a progressive, more liberal strand in the DUP, not progressive and liberal by ordinary political standards, but that is within the DUP. And ultimately, across the party, they didn't like that.
Oh, they did not. But where to now? Well, on Thursday's Morning Ireland, Áine spoke to Deputy Editor of the Belfast Newsletter, Ben Lowry, who traced the thorny path ahead for whoever the incoming leader might be.
Who and how can anyone unite the DUP, stave off electoral defeat next year and vanish the protocol?
Well, it would take something of a genius to do that because of the multiple challenges facing the DUP. There, far from the DUP only being social conservatives, there are a lot of people in the DUP who are socially liberal because a lot of young people are voting for the Alliance Party and expect reform in that. And at the same time, there is a very strong pull towards the right that unionism is facing the biggest crisis in the century and that unionists have to be tough in that. So it's going to be unbelievably difficult for anybody to handle that.
Well, the man who thinks he might be able to is Conservative hardliner Edwin Poots, who is now tipped to become DUP leader. But back to Wednesday, and in her resignation speech, as well as talking about the misogyny and online trolling she had encountered, Arlene Foster reflected on her own party and the future of Northern Ireland.
For almost 5.5 years, I have been incredibly humbled to have had the opportunity to lead the Democratic Unionist Party. I have sought to lead the party and Northern Ireland away from division and towards a better path. There are people in Northern Ireland with a British identity. Others are Irish, others are Northern Irish, others are a mixture of all three, and some are new and emerging. We must all learn to be generous to each other, to live together, and to share this wonderful country. The future of unionism and Northern Ireland will not be found in division. It will only be found in sharing this place we are all privileged to call home.
Arlene Foster, outgoing leader of the Democratic Unionist Party. And the border was the focus for Tom Keeley on Culture File.
My family are Irish. I grew up in England. I have an English accent. I'm studying, but the university I'm based at is in England. I now live in Ireland. I mean, like I said, there's some kind of border in me as well that maybe makes me well placed to think about this stuff. I struggled with feeling like I could have an opinion on it for a good while. I don't feel like that now. But the nuance is the condition, and you can't write a history of the border because it's so contested. But yeah, that whole thing of in the spirit of alternative arrangement, I mean, what do you even call it? The Irish border, if you're in England? I've been very conscious not to call it the Irish border, which is why I call it the Irish borderlands in the title. You know, the Irish border, the border, the British border in Ireland. What do you even call it that kind of can be rearranged alternatively to kind of speak to different moments and different times and different groups? You know, the Derry, Londonderry thing, the North of Ireland, Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland, the Occupied Six. I mean, the lists go on. What you call things is an instant giveaway as to kind of potentially your politics and your position. I think I'm going to try and use all the language. I think whether you're in Great Britain or in some ways some parts of Ireland, we don't look at the border, look away. And aside from any of the politics and the histories, it's a really beautiful place.
In a bit. Welcome back. Ray Darcy was only delighted with the cherry blossoms.
We're getting lovely pictures coming in of the cherry blossom trees from all over the country and the petals and the showers and all that.
Oh, aren't they so pretty? Here comes Aine and Ilona to trample all over his zen.
To It's a stupid tree to grow in Ireland, really, because these are ornamental cherry trees, and they're grown for their blossom. They're Japanese trees, and they epitomise in the Japanese culture this Buddhist thing of thriving in the moment. So, like, there's just a fleeting moment, and you must thrive in this moment and be content in the moment. And the flower, the blossoms will last for about a week, a fortnight at the most. And they start off in the lower half of Japan, and they go up, because Japan is a very long country, so it takes from March to May for it to go up the whole country. But it's only a fleeting moment. And here, normally, the wind comes at the same fleeting moment and it's even more fleeting and they all blow away. But this year we had a good year for the cherry blossoms and they stayed around for quite a long time. And then people were more out this year. They needed to be cheered up. And of course, the cherry blossoms are beautiful and they do cheer people up indeed. So, like, it was a good year for them. But, you know, they're a waste of space. There's no fruit on them. There's nothing to eat. They've all these flowers and then nothing comes. They're ornamental ones. Not the word ornamental.
They're a thing of beauty.
Yeah, but a cherry tree with fruit on them is a thing of beauty too, and you have fruit afterwards.
Right, okay.
So why can't we grow fruiting cherries rather than ornamental ones? You have native Irish cherries, a thing called the wild cherry and the bird cherry. They have lovely flowers on them in spring like the other ones do. They have cherries on them later on, which are food for the birds, food for the pine martens.
Yes.
The other thing is that the cherry blossom trees, the Japanese ones, have very shallow roots. And if you plant them in towns, they burst the footpaths.
Right.
And local authorities have had to take them out because people have fallen over broken footpaths caused by the roots of the cherry trees.
Yeah.
If you notice them, anywhere in towns, they break the footpaths and they only live for about 60 years. So I'm all in favour of cherry trees if you get fruit on them as well. Not just a crowded hour of glorious life. Leave that to the Japanese who want to thrive in the moment. I want fruit afterwards.
You reckon me buzz in any Leona.
Compo cherry trees, Ina. Ripping Ray's dreams to little shreds. But probably not wrong either. She rarely is. But for more of all of this, don't forget the Dawn Chorus starting in the wee hours of Sunday. Always a tonic. On the rolling wave, Aoife na Cormac spoke to Geraldine Cotter from Clare, who had been given a no-frills piano lesson.
Sit down at the piano and just go oompa, oompa. So I sat down at the piano, went oompa, oompa to discover that our piano was not in concert pitch, that it was, so I had to play in E-flat. So because thankfully I loved scales and arpeggios and the piano, so playing in the black keys wasn't an issue to me at all. I just did that. Then I'd go out to Gorpa Farna to the school and the piano was in a different key. I don't know what it was. It was flat anyway. So I would play there. I might have been playing in C maybe or something. And then the only time I'd get to play in concert pitch was when we'd go into the actual competitions. But I never actually remember it being an issue.
Well, that's some talent. Now, Geraldine had done some recording sessions with trad luminaries Peter O'Loughlin, Paddy Canny and Paddy Murphy in the 70s and 80s, but because they weren't that happy with the results, the album was shelved. Now, however, it's been digitally repaired and released under the title Friends of Note. Thursday was Poetry Day Ireland, and ahead of that, Niamh O'Donnell, Director of Poetry Ireland, joined Olivia O'Leary and spoke about the work of Yvan Boland.
So one of the first poetry books that I was ever given was In a Time of Violence by Yvan, and there were two poems in it where I really felt that she reached out of the pages and nearly tipped me over. And the first was Love, which is a beautiful piece, and then the second was This Moment. A neighbourhood at dusk, things are getting ready to happen out of sight. Stars and moths and rinds slanting around fruit, but not yet. One tree is black, one window is yellow as butter. A woman leans down to catch a child who has run into her arms this moment. Stars rise, moths flutter, apples sweeten in the dark.
From the poetry programme on Sunday. The Doc on One podcast series and TV programme Gunplot took us back some 50 years to a time of violent conflict and upheaval in Northern Ireland. Upheaval that would ultimately lead to accusations of gun running and the arms trial in 1970. And given the highly charged nature of the trial, the judge took the unusual step of having it recorded. Here's the voice of Captain James Kelly.
I was awaiting instructions. As regards boss man, it would refer to Mr. Haughey, I would imagine, but I was not one bit worried whom he went to once he got the instructions.
Oh, now, do you want to go back on what you conceded?
I'm not going back on anything. I wanted to get instructions from an official source back in Dublin.
You meant, I suggest, when you made that telephone call, this and this only, that Mr. Haughey would be asked for the final okay.
Well, this is what I assumed that he would ask Mr. Haughey.
Not ask me to assume anything. I asked you, was that what you meant?
Oh, yes, I meant him to go ask Mr. Haughey.
A final okay from Mr. Haughey?
Yes. A final okay. I asked for instructions and I said ask the boss man, which was Mr. Haughey.
Fascinating stuff. Gunplot, the Doc on One podcast series. Twists, turns and treachery. And the number one podcast in the iTunes chart. So no messing there. Now, are you a dirty altruist? How very dare you? But before we get all insulted, what exactly is it?
It's a term that we're using for individuals who would post about charities on social media, particularly Facebook. They do give money to charity, but their primary motivation for posting about it on social media is to impress other people. And they actually admitted that in our survey. So they're people who have personality traits of what we call a high need for uniqueness. They like to stand out.
Say that again.
They have a high need for uniqueness, so they like to stand out from the crowd, but they're also what we call high self-monitors, so they're very much aware of how other people view their profile, and they have a lot of Facebook friends, so they tend to post about charities on social media, partly because they want to show off to other people.
Well, that is Dr. Elaine Wallace, Senior Lecturer in Marketing at NUI Galway, and one of the co-authors of a paper exploring the link between charitable donations and social media. She spoke to Cormac on Drive Time. And if you thought dirty altruists were a little bit suspect, wait till you hear about these guys.
This is a group that intrigues me, the Facebook Expressives. Now, these seem like dirty dogs to me. They don't give, but post on Facebook to look good.
They do. They don't give us correct. What we looked at is the idea of conspicuous donation behaviour. And this has previously been looked at offline, where people want to, for instance, wear something associated with a charity to look good. Well, these guys actually do this on social media. So they want to make an impression on other people. But when we measure their intention to donate either time or money, it's really low. So they actually don't really have much interest in giving. They just want to engage with whatever campaign is ongoing. So they have a very high number of Facebook friends and they really want to stand out. But unlike the dirty altruist, they don't give money. So they're actually just, we believe, they're using social media for self-expressive purposes. And charity is just one way for them to do that. So they're posting about charity, yeah.
You're so diplomatic, Elaine. For self-expressive purposes. For pure narcissism, is it?
Well, and in this study, we didn't actually measure narcissism, but we looked at the extent to which they have a need to stand out. And certainly that is the case. They have a very high need to stand out.
Wow.
And they also post about the charities because they believe that's very socially acceptable.
And Cormac went fishing for a little bit of judgment, but came up short.
I suppose as an academic, you can't pass judgment, can you?
Not at all. I can just look at the data.
I wonder what's going through your mind, though, when you're discussing these people or writing the paper.
Well, actually, when we looked at it, the point about this group is you might say, well, what is the point in targeting that group? But, you know, they have a very large number of Facebook friends. And so they're really valuable as sources of word of mouth. So even though they mightn't give themselves, at least if they post about charity, then their large friendship networks will see it. And that might create awareness among other people who would donate.
So overall worth it to the charities in question. From Drive Time. Remember this? Yeah, the sound of Ryan released, bouncing, happy as a puppy putting chat on everyone. But what about the rest of us? Do we have it in us to make the small talk, or will we just be fine?
How are you? Good. And yourself? Good. And yourself? Good. And yourself? Good. We're just two people in this conversation. And yet, repetitive asking of the how are you? And of course, in Ireland, we say I'm fine, which is shorthand for I've had the worst day in my life. I can't tell you just how bad it's been, but I'm not going to tell you that because I don't know you well enough. Don't trust you. I don't particularly like you. So I'm going to keep going now because I have to buy some bananas in the supermarket. See ya. Bye. Ireland, a conversation. We don't do small talk now like we used to. So we have to get back on the small talk bus. God help us all.
Well, if that awkwardness and frankly anxiety rings a bell, you might want to do some of this. That's the sound of psychologist Tony Bates and Brendan O'Connor in unison, releasing tension, possibly quite a lot of it, because this past year, it's been something else. And when we finally begin to exhale, the body and the belly will be key.
Turns out the gut instinct, you know that term, we all have our gut instinct. Well, it turns out that that's not a metaphor. This is this tremendous truth in this. So we have a nerve, the vagus nerve, that goes from the stomach to the brain. And it's like a highway. But, you know, 80% of the nerves are going one way from the belly to the brain. And only 20% are going from the brain to the belly. So if you like, the belly is doing most of the talking. In trauma or in high toxic stress situations, that communication gets very disrupted. It gets all twisted. We don't know what our belly is trying to tell us. So one of the things that the belly keeps doing is telling the brain there's fire in the hole. You know, there's something not right down here. There's something not. Okay. And the poor old brain then is hearing this. And all the guys that are working in the fight flight response department, the brain keeps them on full alert because things are not right. If we could get into the belly and if we could talk to the vagus nerve and get it to send a different message, it's quite possible that it would be possible for our whole body to kind of relax.
And based on the work of Peter Levine, it involves this.
Voo. I say V-O-O, saying the word voo as I breathe out, okay?
That's V for Victor.
V for Victor, O-O, okay? So I kind of wanted
voo.
to voo.
Okay, so it's a long one.
So it's a long exhale and voo. I'm letting it vibrate on my belly. Great. All together now. Now, the voo sound begins to stimulate up to the brain and then you'll notice that your shoulders begin to tingle or tremble. And tingling and trembling is a great sign that we're releasing stress and we come back in. And we need in the next year to give people a kind of a wide berth because people are going to release their own tension in their own way. And people are going to socially re-engage. And there's going to be a party of some sort for a certain length of time. And then it'll pass and life will go on. But we need to trust people. We need to be very human at this time. We need to, you know, and just really trust that we're all struggling. And these are the normal ways that we come through are we recognise, we release and we re-engage, we regroup.
Wise words indeed. Clinical psychologist Tony Bates with Brendan at the weekend. That is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. Oh, and one more time. Voo.